This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
You're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast. This is, well, some of the best bits from Thursday, June the 13th. Busy old show for us, always is, on the back of a Federal Reserve decision. That decision, not a big surprise. They kept rates on hold, interest rates on hold, that is. But obviously we looked at the impact that had, not just on the US economy, but also the UAE economy, with the UAE dirham pegged to the US dollar. Plus, we also looked at the IPO stories. I mean, we often talk about the IPO boom here in the region. And that's why the latest IPO was something of a surprise, because it was anything but boom on the first day of trading. Not to say that it's a complete failure. We wait with bated breath and interest to see what the Aleph IPO does moving forward. But certainly fair to say that it flattered to deceive on the first day of trading down in Abu Dhabi. Talking of Abu Dhabi, we've also got news coming through today that NMC, the hospitals operator, is looking at the possibilities and the options of an IPO, which would be an extraordinary turnaround in fortunes. Details on both of those stories. We also had John Defterios, the former CNN anchor and now a senior fellow at the World Economic Forum in Energy and Materials, and former emerging markets editor, as we said, of CNN. He joined us live in studio for an extended interview. A look at some of the big stories of the days, and a catch up with John on where he's at the moment. Raj Kotecha, also returning to the studio, who's the CEO of Creative Content Agency, runs a number of courses for the Chartered Institute of Marketing for companies to talk to them about how content can improve their brands. He was in to talk about, guess what? AI and the impact it was having on content creation at the moment, and how Instagram, in fact, were taking something of a stand to clarify and be more transparent about the use of AI. And Denny Abraham is Associate Director at Aspas Real Estate. He was in to react to the interest rate decision, but also give us a bit of an overview going into the summer of the real estate market. Are there any cracks in the exterior for real estate here in the region? All those stories and much more right here on the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast. Let's start with all things Fed, if we can, Mr. Dean.
Yeah, last night we had three things from the Fed. Firstly, the decision kept rates on hold. We knew they would. So we were more interested in their predictions of what they will do next and commentary from Jay Powell. Predictions came in the form of a new dot plot. This is where the economists pencil in where they think rates are going. One more this year is the consensus. One rate cut this year from the Fed is the consensus on the new dot plot. And we heard from Jay Powell. He didn't give a huge amount of way, but this was him saying, everyone's getting very excited, we've got a new dot plot. But he said, forecasting interest rates is not an exact science, even for the economists who make policy at the Fed. This is what he had to say.
What I hear and see is that people are looking at you know, a range of plausible outcomes. And in many cases, they're thinking, I don't really, you know, I can't really distinguish between two of these. They're so close for me. These are very close calls. But we ask them to write down the most likely one. So they do. But what everyone agrees on is it's going to be data dependent. No one brings to this or takes away from it a really strong commitment to a particular rate path. It's actually just their forecast and it's a combination of their forecast and their own reaction function.
Yeah, a reminder that economics is a social science, not a natural science, and not therefore not an exact science. So what does all this mean for us? Selfishly, that's why we care here in the UAE. Of course, the UAE Central Bank immediately following suit, holding UAE base rate at 5.4% overnight. Here's Ed Bell of Emirates NBD.
For the UAE, it's going to mean that interest rates remain unchanged from now, making new borrowing relatively more expensive than it had been over the last several years. Or for anyone with exposure to a floating interest payment, no imminent relief. While rates in the UAE have tracked the moves in the US, we have not seen a material slowdown in activity in the country that we can explicitly link back to higher borrowing costs. So for now, we continue to see robust activity in the non-oil sector of the UAE, even as rates stay high.
Ed Bell of Emirates NBD.
Send our attention to the decision, or the warnings, I should say, from the IEA. More long-term, the IEA warning that the world is facing a staggering surplus of oil by the end of the decade. We've also had that Citi analysis as well from Citigroup suggesting that we could see oil at $60 a barrel by the end of next year, 2025, again, because of oversupply and lack of demand therein as well. That's something we asked Ed about as well, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah. So we asked him, do you agree with that IEA analysis? Not everyone does, OPEC doesn't. But if you do agree, or if people agree, what would it mean for the Gulf economies if they're right?
The IEA published their long-term oil market outlook, where they see oil consumption hitting a peak by 2030 and then getting to a plateau level as demand declines in some markets are offset by growth elsewhere. What they also highlight is what the global economy is going to be consuming. Fewer transport fuels like petrol or diesel, but more petrochemical products for plastics and other materials. At the same time, growth in oil demand is going to come to an end, the IEA still expects to see substantial supply coming online. The US, Guyana, Brazil, Canada will be among the large contributors to supply growth outside of OPEC+. While within that producers alliance, countries like the UAE and Iraq are going to have substantial capacity additions before 2030. So that's going to mean that markets should have a considerable buffer of supply that will be a long-term headwind to prices. These are, of course, long-term projections, but most estimates are that transport fuels in many developed economies have already hit their peak. So stretching that trend into 2030 doesn't look particularly far-fetched.
Edward Bell there, Senior Director, Market Economics at Emirates NBD. One other story we are following for you today is the story of local IPOs. On the whole, I mean, if you were to write an end-of-term report, IPOs have been good over the last calendar year. They've been good over the last academic year. IPOs in recent history have been good. And here's hoping, Deanie, that they remain good. We'll wait for the markets to open a little later on.
Well, yeah, because it wasn't a good day yesterday. Aleph, the education company in Abu Dhabi, bell ringing ceremony at 10 o'clock yesterday morning. All the great and the good were there. Ding, 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 wee! And then plop. Shares fell 18.18%, closed 13% lower. A bit of a damp squib. Look, it can happen. You know, if you list your shares on the stock market, they're going to rise, they're going to fall. That's the reality. Let's get a take of Mohammed Yassin. He is the founder and CEO of Oracle Financial Consultancy and Investments in Abu Dhabi.
The question here is, will this be a unique case to this IPO, or will it be, people may take it as an end of a phase of the IPO boom that we saw? I believe it's, I think there's still liquidity in the market. There's still liquidity with investors. The appetite is still positive for the right company in the right sector at the right valuation with a good diversified revenue stream, not concentrated in one area, and with a good sustainable growth story and the profit and dividend.
Mohammed Yassin giving his thoughts there.
This is the Bite-Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right then, for the next half an hour or so, we're going to get the story behind the headlines of these business stories, not just today, but in the first half of the year. Joined in the studio by a special guest this morning, John Defterios. John, good morning.
Thank you, Richard. Nice to see you.
To me, you need no introduction because I grew up watching you on CNN, but I'm going to give you one anyway. Former anchor at CNN, currently visiting professor of business at NYU Abu Dhabi, senior fellow at the World Economic Forum in Energy and Materials. So, John knows his beans. Given your World Economic Forum fellowship and the energy focus, you've lived in Abu Dhabi, Dubai for many years as well. You follow this industry. Can we start with that IEA story? Overnight, the report from the International Energy Agency saying the world is facing a, quote, staggering oil surplus by the end of this decade. America and the Middle East pumping just too much oil as demand falls as we all go green. This is Fatty Birol, a man you know well, the head of the International Energy Agency, explaining why the weakness in demand.
What are the key drivers of the slowdown of the global oil demand growth? I see three major drivers. The first one is on the transportation sector. The major penetration of the electric cars in China, in Europe, US, and more in the emerging countries is a key driver.
Discuss.
Well, it's very interesting. It's very controversial, which we can get into here. He's correct. And I have a lot of respect for Fatih Birol. I've interviewed him many times. We're going to see demand in the OECD countries drop from 49 million barrels a day to 43 million barrels a day by 2030. That's the story for the developed economies. But I think the IEA has underestimated the demand's going to come from the global south. So if you look at the projections to try to get to net zero in this goal for the globe to cap global warming at 1.5 degrees centigrade, in the IEA projections, and this is what raised some flags, they don't show any growth from Africa in terms of demand or Latin America or Southeast Asia. I travel the world still in the energy space, both in the hydrocarbons and the renewable sector. That's just not reality. The global growth is coming from the global south. So he's saying that we're going to cap demand at 106 million barrels a day. If you look at the OPEC expectations going to 2040 to 2045, they still see demand holding at about 100 million barrels a day because they see the global demand from the global south still rising, Richard. And in fact, it was so controversial, and I thought this was interesting in March. We had the head of the Energy and Resources Committees from the House and the Senate write a letter to the IEA saying that your projections have been off. So you're trying to encourage an energy transition, but so far, OPEC's research has been more accurate on demand. And even Shell put out a report in the first half of the year saying that LNG demand for natural gas is going to grow 50% to 2040. It's a cleaner fuel. But again, that demand is going to come from other parts, the developing world, the emerging markets of the world, which is a point of focus here for the UAE to try to tap into that growth.
So where does the UAE fit into all this? Sultan Al Jaber, again, someone you know well, has got a foot in both camps, green and hydrocarbons. Day job, CEO of ADNOC, Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, as we always knew it. But he was also the president of COP28 and is a big advocate of renewable energies. Masdar City is where he cut his teeth. Let's hear from Sultan Al Jaber now. This is him speaking recently on the need for green energy.
We need to massively scale up clean energies by 2030, triple renewable capacity to 11,000 gigawatt and double hydrogen production to 180 million tons.
Seems like the UAE is backing both camps. Can you do that?
Fantastic question, by the way. You know the strategy here is to boost capacity to 5 million barrels a day. They're already at above 4 million barrels a day. I think the strategy here is they realize that demand will tail off after 2040. So the idea is to produce as much oil as you can in this next two decades, which is crucial. And I think it's a wise strategy. What Dr. Sultan has said, and I have the honor to chair ADIPEC every year, is that we want to do it as cleanly as possible. So they're front loading the production now because they see the energy transition coming. Now, in the COP28, he was very instrumental in getting the language here as an orderly transition out of hydrocarbons, which was very controversial with the other Gulf producers, particularly in Saudi Arabia. But it did mark a big pivot point in the energy transition coming forward. But we're trying to triple your renewable energy capacity by 2030. It's probably not doable, but it was very positive that we crossed $2 trillion in terms of investments into renewables in 2023 for the first time. But the International Renewable Energy Agency in Abu Dhabi is saying you need to have $4.3 trillion a year for the next 20 years to be able to cap global warming at 1.5 degrees. We've already surpassed it, but can we come back down by introducing more renewable capacity going forward? So far, these are kind of dreamland figures because we're just not there yet. But it's coming. It's just slower than expected.
From energy to artificial intelligence, Tom, you've got a bell or something, haven't you, every time someone mentions AI?
I think you guys have too much fun in the morning, by the way. I still listen to you when I'm in London, so it's good stuff.
It's nice.
You should have, that bell would have been ringing all the time, Tom, if you were in Davos in 2024, because the whole promenade was every sign on every shop had AI on it. There you go. Just keep it ringing for the next 10 minutes.
Well, let's talk about Davos, because we're going to hear now from Satya Nadella, CEO of Microsoft. This is him speaking in Davos. In January this year, you were there, snow-capped peaks of the Swiss ski resort, talking about AI and the UAE's role in it.
The UAE has rolled out a personalized tutor for every student in the country. In fact, I think Bill first talked about information at your fingertips at Comdex in 93. And this is more about intelligence at your fingertips or expertise at your fingertips. Think about it. You have now technology like something like GPT-4 that essentially can be used to create a personal tutor for every student in the world, right? It's absolutely economically feasible, even with just the government spending that's happening even in the global south, right? So it's not just in the UAE, but it can happen everywhere.
And you've picked up on the fact that Microsoft, his company, bought a $1.5 billion stake in Abu Dhabi's G42.
Good. That's both laced with business practices, which is really wise because they know how important AI is, ring the bell, because they see this as a key pillar of future growth for the UAE. You have to give the CEO of Microsoft incredible kudos because he got them into cloud in a very rapid way, and he's ahead of the curve on AI, NVIDIA crossing $3 trillion in terms of market cap and going for a stock split. So they're good harbingers for the future. I think the market's gotten ahead of that, as it often happens. So you see the valuations at a very high peak right now. I saw an interview with His Excellency Omar Olama, the Minister of AI, this week, and he was pointing to the fact that they have been working in this space since 2017. And I think where the advantage for the UAE is, as you well know, for the last three decades, they built incredible infrastructure to attract capital into the financial sector, fintech, which is very strong here. They see AI as a next extension of diversification. And if you look at non-oil GDP in the UAE now, and the figure was just recently updated, it's 70%.
10 seconds, final thought on this one, John.
On AI itself?
On AI, yeah.
I think the hype is incredible. I think the other story that often gets overlooked is the threat of cybersecurity and the impact quantum computing and AI will have on our cybersecurity systems.
Our guest this morning is John Def Terrios, for decades the face of CNN as one of their anchors and emerging markets editor, currently visiting professor of business at NYU Abu Dhabi and senior fellow at the World Economic Forum. John, thanks for sticking around.
My pleasure.
Let's turn our attention to elections now. We've just had India. Modi survived, only just, but he did. So we look forwards now. First of all, to the US election. Tom is DJ today. Tom, can we have a bit of Donald Trump on the election rally?
Of course you can.
The date, remember this, November 5th, I believe it's going to be the most important date in the history of our country. I believe that.
John, you're a proud American. What's your take?
Well, it's extraordinary because I was in the United States four times last year, and it's as divided as ever. So I'm actually quite worried about the election. If Donald Trump does lose, I think there's a threat of kind of uprisings, and I don't want to overplay it. I also find it extraordinary because this is a business program. If you look at the state of the U.S. economy right now, U.S. is growing around 2.5%, probably hold by 1.8% next year. Under President Biden, 15 million jobs were created. We've had unemployment below 4% for the last 30 months, the first time on record. And there's an obsession with inflation. And we saw the latest Fed report at 3.3%. It's high. I think we were spoiled for the last 20 years with lower inflation. The base for Donald Trump is incredibly solid. If you look at the five swing states that really do call the election right now, President Biden is trailing. Instinctually, and I worked in Washington, as you know, for 5 years in politics before going into journalism again, there's a center band that's kind of being ignored right now. They don't have a major voice in the United States, and there's been a lot of legislation, five major bills passed by Joe Biden. Think coming out of the pandemic, the U.S. has done extremely well, but the debt levels are high, 120% of GDP, which is extraordinary. If we had that conversation 10 years ago and I said it's going to be that in 2024, you'd say, John, you're bananas. But the American public has felt the squeeze of higher food inflation, healthcare inflation, education inflation, and it's hurting him right now. And he's not as robust as he was even 5 years ago, Joe Biden. There was an interview now, and there's a big argument in Congress to release the audio of this because his memory's faulting and the White House is resisting, for example. And that does hang over him like a cloud, even though the economic track record's very good. And, you know, Donald Trump kind of portrays America at its worst. It's not the case. It's extremely divided. And politically, I'm quite worried, and even on a security front.
That's the American election happening in November. Before that, Tom, we've got an election a couple of weeks' time, haven't we, in the UK? And you are based now in London, aren't you, John?
Yes.
Indeed, we do. And what is that, July the 4th? Interesting day to choose a UK election, isn't it? but again, you've got foot in camps on either side of the Atlantic, a long-term resident of the UK as well, spend a lot of your time there. How do you read that one as well? I mean, could Rishi Sunak be getting this any more wrong at the moment with the campaign that just seems to go from one disaster to yet another?
Well, he did take over a poison chalice, right? We've had four prime ministers, right, because of Brexit and Liz Truss and Boris Johnson. And, you know, it's been tumultuous. I don't think he has a chance at winning, let's put it that way. The D-Day departure was absolutely ridiculous, particularly because they had that photo op with all the leaders of the world there. So it was a big miscalculation. He's not very charismatic. What I think is extraordinary right now is that when I watched the debate last week and even in the conversations daily, even in the leading newspapers, they don't talk about Brexit. Mm-hmm. And there was a survey last night that showed that only 24% of Britain today thinks that Brexit was a good idea. It's extraordinary how much it's undermined the economy, but it's so politically sensitive that Sir Keir Starmer doesn't even want to raise it because he doesn't want to lose anybody that's, you know, was pro-Brexit. Then you have Nigel Farage coming in as the spoiler, and he's polling at like 17% in a short period of time, saying that it's been a wonderful thing. Boris Johnson, I had him on a fireside chat about 6 months ago. I delivered Brexit, but I was ready with the data. There's not one indicator that said it's good for the UK economy. What is extraordinary is London, and The Economist ran a piece about a month ago talking about the regeneration of London itself. It's really popping again. The City of London real estate has picked up again. The housing prices have gone up again. It's stabilized. But as an economy, the UK is not what it was prior to Brexit. And they just don't want to deal with the elephant in the room because it's so politically sensitive.
Finally, the global economy. We've got a G7 meeting starting today in Italy, another place where you have lived and had a home.
Yeah, only one person's hope. No, my wife's Italian and Greek. That's the connection.
Oh, there you go. So Giorgia Meloni is the Prime Minister of Italy. She's hosting the G7 meeting in Puglia, starts today. Let's quickly hear her take on the global economy.
Our nation has experienced an unprecedented social and economic decline, with a progressive deterioration of public finances, the quality of life of citizens, and the competitiveness of our businesses. With the left in power, the state has turned hostile to citizens and businesses, increasingly violating individual liberties.
Less than a minute, the global economy discuss.
Well, that's a good one. 3.2% doesn't sound too bad, but most of that growth is coming from where I used to focus at CNN, in the emerging markets, right? India's power, China stabilized, Southeast Asia's growing, Africa's growing, South America's growing. But the core, if you look at the G7 economies right now, the Eurozone is growing about only 1%. I'm not expecting a lot from the G7 summit. They're going to talk about getting finance to Africa, the Middle East. President Zelensky from Ukraine is going to be there as well. Giorgia Meloni is very popular in Italy. She's not as right-wing as everybody has to say. G7, G20, really not showing anything in terms of breakthroughs right now. But I'd say after the pandemic, with inflation, the global economy is not bad. People are complaining a lot. Considering what was thrown at us for the last 5 years, Richard and Tom, I think it's pretty steady sailing. High debt levels, though, in the G7 is not encouraging.
We'll have to leave it there. John Defterios, always a pleasure. Former CNN anchor, current visiting professor of business at NYU Abu Dhabi and senior fellow at the World Economic Forum. Nice to see you.
Nice
Thanks
to see you both.
In.
We'll see you next time I'm here.
John, cheers. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Good to catch up. A big thanks to our special guest, John Defterios, this hour.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Right, for all those that have been checking their Insta feeds recently, or their Insta profiles, you might have noticed something a little bit different recently. Why? Instagram now asking users to declare if their post has been made with or without enhanced, or with or enhanced by AI. There is even a little tab on the screen for you asking said question. To tell us what this is all about, we are joined now by the CEO of creative content agency, Raj Kotecha, who's also the course director at the Chartered Institute Institute of Marketing, where he trains Fortune 500 companies on AI-enabled content production. Raj, always good to catch up with you. Welcome.
Always lovely to see you.
So here we have this new little feature on the gram. What's it mean? And what's it mean more specifically for the future of business?
So since AI has built momentum in the last 18 months, one of the parts of AI that is doing extremely well and has been adopted quite quickly by consumers is what's known as generative AI. Mm. Effectively, this means that you write a prompt into an AI service and you can generate text and images, videos, and even audio. This means that you're not necessarily reliant on producing content that you've captured on your phone from the real world. It's something that can come purely from your imagination, and it can then be turned into a piece of content. That piece of content, of course, then can be published onto a content platform like Instagram, and it raises the question, is this content real and from the real world, or is it from the imagination and generated by AI?
That's interesting, because obviously, you know, I think of the blue ticks of recent discussions, etc., and this striving for authenticity or accreditation, if you like, credibility is the word we're looking for here. Is this another step towards that as well, albeit a credibility away from generated content as opposed to creative content?
I think what Instagram is doing by asking people to declare if the content is made by or enhanced by AI is it's actually giving its users an opportunity to say, hey, listen, this has been involved in the process. Now, on the spectrum, there are many things that are considered AI. It could be something as simple as removing somebody from the background of a holiday picture. You know, we've all been photobombed when we're taking that one pristine picture on holiday, and we think it would be slightly better if we were able to just cut that person out. That's considered AI, as well as completely coming up with something from your imagination, like a cat on a skateboard. Now, these are obviously all fun things or things that we can use in the real world, but of course, there could be more nefarious actors that could create things to, you know, perhaps spread fake news. And what Instagram is trying to do is get ahead of that and make sure that the kind of content that goes on its platforms is both truthful and authentic and not misleading for its users.
Listen, we can't. There isn't a day, let alone a week, that goes past without another AI-generated headline out there at the moment. It's been a week of AI focus here in the UAE. We've had the announcement of 22 chief AI officers by His Highness Sheikh Hamdan a little earlier on this week as part of a new initiative. Your reaction to that?
Wonderful. The reason why I think it's an exceptional move by His Highness is that, firstly, not only has the UAE been extremely proactive in developing a ministry for AI, we're talking about 2017, way before AI became a mainstream conversation like it is today, but specifically around the move of having 22 chief AI officers, you have to think about it like a highway. AI is like a platform technology like the internet. So if we had one person in charge of the internet in the UAE, that would surely not be enough bandwidth to deal with the aspects of society that the internet affects. Well, AI is as big as that. And so AI is going to enhance the quality of life, which of course has always been the focus for the UAE to make sure that the quality of life for residents is exceptionally high. But we're talking about infrastructure, schooling, education, electricity, water. And so to have 22 AI officers means that we effectively have a 22-lane highway, which is going to allow us to have more throughput around the conversation around policy and also bringing the world's best AI actors, developers, and community and companies to the UAE to participate, because there's not a single tech company in the world that doesn't have Dubai as a city and as a society on its kind of like wish list in terms of where it wants to roll out.
Couldn't have come at a better time as well, could it? The same week, almost the same day that Apple released their Apple Intelligence. A little bit surprised that it's taken Apple this long to join the race?
No. And I'll tell you why. Because Apple was not the first person to put out a portable media player, but they kind of galvanized it with the iPod. They were not the first people to put out tablets. They were not the first people to launch a music service. What Apple tends to do quite well is it tends to put the consumer right at the middle of its story. Apple, if nothing else, is a storytelling brand. And now what it's going to do is validate and legitimize AI. They've obviously done it in a very Apple way by calling it Apple Intelligence, but they've also captured the attention of the kind of core AI community by partnering with ChatGPT, which has already a tremendous amount of credibility and is the front-running brand. ChatGPT, you could argue, is the Apple of the AI world.
Just finally, and I mentioned at the beginning that you're now training Fortune 500 companies and CEOs within those companies on AI-enabled content production as part of your course for the Chartered Institute of Marketing. What's the common theme there? What's the biggest concern amongst CEOs and big companies at the moment when it comes to AI moving forward?
Well, AI, like I said, can go from anything that comes from your imagination. I think what the biggest priority right now for companies is putting out what I'm calling undeniable social proof, or right. USP, right? There are a million things that you could create, and AI has certainly increased the amount of things that you could create. I think what we're seeing now is a shift back towards the middle, towards authentic content. So the biggest ROI that I'm seeing these companies that I consult get comes from the basics nowadays. So testimonials, case studies, putting the attention right back on the kind of stuff that helps businesses convert. And I think the same way that we've gone from an era of like vinyl to tapes to CDs to MP3s, but now when you go to a vinyl bar, it's considered more authentic. Mm. Although we can do tremendous things when it comes to AI produced content, going back to those kind of like core media formats, you know, even if it's behind the scenes content of your business, that's the kind of stuff that's doing really well.
Raj, good to see that you're doing really well as well, both professionally and personally. Congratulations to you and all. Raj Kotecha, great to have you here in Dubai. Thanks so much indeed for joining us.
Real pleasure to be here.
A big thanks to Raj for joining us live here in the studio. This is the Business Breakfast.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
What does that interest rate story mean for the real estate sector? Normally one of the most interest rate sensitive in the world. Danny Abrahams here, Associate Director, Espace Real Estate. Morning, Danny.
Morning, gents. How are we?
We're good, thanks very much indeed. I'd be good. Better if the US had cut interest rates by 2% last night, because I've got a mortgage here and I've had it a while now, so I'm on a floating rate. So it's killing me at the moment, the repayments. Mm-hmm. But he didn't. What does it mean for real estate?
What does it mean? Good question. I think, look, Dubai has been on a huge trajectory over the last 4 years. And if we go back even a couple of years of what the rate's done from, I think the lowest part would have been around 2.49%. They've gone up to about 5.25%. And at the moment, the best rate we're seeing in the market for a five-year fixed is with Rackbank at 3.98 without a salary transfer. And then there's a two-year fixed rate at 3.94 with a salary transfer with Fab Bank. I think for me, if we genuinely look at what's happened, even when I took a rate, I was much higher than where we're at now, I was close to 4.7. I think people just want to own here now still. I think it's still a big thing that the rents are so high. If you look at actually what you're... if you take, for example, you're saying your rates are high, I'm sure you're still lower than what you would be paying to rent the equivalent property. So it's good that it hasn't gone up. I think they mentioned that they most probably have one more decrease this year, which will be nice. It certainly will give more confidence. But what we're seeing generally at the moment, it just hasn't slowed down, even when they were up closer to the five mark. And that's really like... people are getting confidence in these key communities of villas where people are renovating these properties and seeing stuff that's, you know, suddenly you're buying something at a standard unit of 7 million, they're potentially saying at 11 or 12. People saying, actually, that's giving me confidence. I can go in, I've got equity, I'll put the money into the property, and they're not really too fussed about, you know, the mortgage rate. I think they're just confident about getting in and securing their home.
Because I confidently predicted 2 years ago when the Fed began its rate hiking cycle, well, this could be the thing 18 months ago that takes the heat out of the Dubai real estate market, late 2022, early 2023, because the market was absolutely on fire then.
Yeah.
And it just didn't happen. But theoretically, I was right. Yeah. Aggressively rising interest rates should have taken the heat out of the real estate market. And certainly if you look at commercial property in the United States, offices, it absolutely has.
Yeah.
But it just didn't happen here. Is that because mortgages or home loans are less of a deal here? We just got stinking rich cash buyers?
Well, no, people definitely are still taking mortgages. We've certainly seen a little bit of a cool off on the very high end. You know, stuff over 25, 30 million has definitely slowed down slightly, because I guess there's only so many multimillionaires that can move into the country and buy these properties cash. Saying that, actually, we did sell two properties yesterday, over 25 million marks. So it's still there.
Just the two.
Just the two. It'd be great if it happened every day. But it's, you know, that is still there. The market is there, but maybe not as fast-paced. I think now, you know, with the market where it is, with the interest rates staying the same, it will most probably continue. I think, obviously, summer does tend to slow down a lot because a lot of people leave and take time out. But at the moment, it's a real shortage of supply. You know, we look at one of the areas I cover. I was doing the stats yesterday. We have 8 properties in Meadows listed because everything's selling. Normally, we would be up to like 30. And then literally, properties come on. If it's priced right, it will sell within a week. And it's just, there's so much demand. And I think that is the real reason on any market is supply and demand. And, you know, the amount of people that are moving in and they're looking at, right, God, I've got to go and rent a Meadows property at 600,000. You know, I may as well get a mortgage, which I could secure maybe at 350 a year, and I own it. I'm paying it off rather than paying someone else's mortgage. And I think that's what's given the confidence. And I think, you know, sentiment to Dubai, a lot of people want to move here. And it's a lot of new money that comes in. There's a lot of more European money coming into the country. So, you know, it always used to be the Indian buyers, Pakistani buyers, just a lot of Iranian. Now it's a lot of, you know, German, Italian, British that are coming in and, you know, yes, quite successful at their own right. But for everything that Dubai and UAE has to offer, they want to base themselves here. And I don't think that's slowing down.
What about supply then? You cover the south of the city, which is a big area.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at some of the off-plan development or some of the construction that's happening and new launches, that supply is coming in that part of town. Whether it's, you know, look at Talal Al Ghaf by Majid Al Futtaim is in that bracket that you're talking about. That's a big development. And there are others like it as well. Dubai South, lots of villa communities coming up. Is that supply, when it comes on board, could that tip the market?
I still think the demand outweighs what is coming. And I think also the location, if, you know, everything at the moment in the area I am, people are, this is the area they want to be at. Correct, in 10 years' time with the new airport and everything that's coming, maybe the centre of gravity will shift slightly and go more central. So, you know, for me, I still think there's not enough villas. You know, I think if there's around, if we look at the last year, I think there was 100,000 people that with new visas that came into Dubai, and only 8,000 villas were handed over. That still outweighs how many people want to come and buy these properties. So
most,
yes,
people,
they're coming.
A quick word on apartments. I know your colleague's going to be in about 5 minutes' time answering some more questions, but that below the $1 million mark, okay, for 1, 2, 3 million dirhams for a 2-3 bedroom apartment. What's happening in that market? Still a shortage of supply there?
No, I think again, if it's again a developer that they feel confident in, it's in a good location with a good view and the yielding perspective. Because I think the difference with apartments, it's a mix of investors and also end users. There's a lot more investors that come in that are purely looking for yield bases, and they do offer good yield. They've also got the opportunity to put these properties on short-term let now. You know, a lot of people, if they want to come in and use it for 2 months of the year themselves and 10 months, they rent it out and they're generating income. So that market's still doing very, very well. We're seeing our, you know, apartment team grow at a space, you know, that we've... you know, highly recruiting there because, again, the demand is very high. So,
Danny, we're going to have to leave it there for now. So you are out of the witness box now.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.